Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Marky.
Good morning there, Francis.
How are you?
I'm doing good, man. You had a fun little day yesterday, did you?
I actually have had a fun morning this morning, and I want to recommend your wife to everyone. I love chocolate-covered Oreos. This is like not high cuisine. We're not only about high cuisine.
Jozo's, baby. No trans fats.
Oh, they were Jozo's?
Yeah, baby.
So where do you buy those? What store?
Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's. You can buy Jozo's. Anyway, Mark brought me some Jozo's chocolate covered by his wife at home. She just had some Valrhona chocolate, which you can buy online. And
you can get a couple of the stores. Who carries it? Whole Foods carries Valrhona chocolate.
Valrhona chocolate. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Awesome. Melt it.
In chips. You just melt it in a double boiler. And
dip an Oreo in there.
Dip away and
holy
let
cow.
It solidify and yippee.
That was
breakfast of champions.
That was really bad for me and really good. Yes, yesterday I sat on an interesting panel. I was with I was invited to sit on a panel having a discussion about Long Island wines, and we tasted about 40 Long Island wines, and there were some friends of mine there. There were only about 8 of us.
Mm-hmm. But what was the panel for?
A friend is writing her dissertation for her Master of Wine degree, probably as we speak, and the topic is Long Island wines, and it's the whole industry of Long Island wines, and she's going to do a great job. She's a really intelligent lady.
What's her name?
Her name is Lisa Granick. And she's going to be an MW, I'm sure of it. Mm-hmm. But I sat with another MW, Mary Ewing Mulligan, who's been a hero of ours for a long time. 14 years ago, the New York Times wrote an article about a consumer wine class that we teach. And they called a couple of people to ask them what they thought, and they called Kevin Zarelli, and he was quoted saying nice things. And Mary Ewing Mulligan was quoted as saying, you know, it seems like a really great class. The wines are well chosen, but it seems like there are too many wines. That was great. We were full beverages. Thank you for that. Best criticism I ever got.
Too many wines, and such good wines. Why are they pouring us? It was something like that.
No, it was something like, you know, your students will suffer palate fatigue. Well, people don't care. They want a value. So that was good. So we sat on this panel, and it was really interesting, and we had about 40.
Well, hold on. I want to go back to the whole palate fatigue thing, because just give me 1 second on that. What people don't realize is your palate, you'll get tired. If you taste a lot of wines over and over again, your tongue will actually get tired and not taste as well. The same thing with a smell. You'll notice if you walk into a room and there's a really heavy aroma, you'll only smell that for a little while because your nose will get tired of that.
Well, and if you
smell.
Taste a number of wines in a wine tasting or something like that, after a point, all wines begin to taste alike. You begin to lose the ability to differentiate. And professionals can go longer without suffering from palate fatigue, and that's like being an athlete. It's there mm-hmm. are two aspects to that. One is some people have a knack for it, and just also like being an athlete, the more you do it and the more you concentrate on it and the more you train your brain to continue to differentiate, the better you get at it.
But that was one of the things that I wanted to bring up is in the class we taste about 18 to 20, sometimes 24 wines a night, somewhere in that range. And in that class, what you'll see is people – in the first few weeks, 10, 12 wines, they start to lose the ability to differentiate. Now, Francis and I and in other classes I've been to, what you generally try and do is start with the lighter wines and move on to the heavier wines so that you still are perceiving differences in each of the wines. But what you see at the end of week 6 or 7 or 8 is you see those same people who were suffering palate fatigue at 10 or 12 weeks are now all of a sudden able to taste wines in week 18, up to wine 18 or wine 20.
And different people do it at different pace.
But it's interesting.
Well, yesterday was interesting because we tasted about 40 Long Island wines, reds and whites, from a number of different producers from a number of different regions, and we did them all blind with some ringers in there. A ringer is when you stick a Bordeaux in with a Long mm-hmm. Island blind wine tasting. And we were like, oh, yeah, that's the ringer. How can we tell? Because it's really good.
I mean, that's not a good sign. Now, we've had some Long Island wines that we've really, really enjoyed.
Barbara Shin and David Page are friends of ours. They've done dinners at the restaurant. I love
some
a lot of
great Merlots. That six-barrel Merlot is delicious.
But Long Island, I think the conclusion that I drew, and I have, you know, I was just there to give.
It's not your thesis.
It's not my thesis.
Right.
You know? But the conclusion that I came to, and also I was there with my friends Beth Von Benz and Scott Mayer, who are wine consultants. I found that the problem out there is price. A lot of the wines, you know, they're not great. Okay, I'll be honest with you, they're not great. And we've had some wines that weren't represented in the tasting that were great, like the Bergen Road from Macari Vineyards.
A great wine.
We've had the last year's vintage.
Bedell Cellars.
But we had a couple of Bedell Cellars in this blind tasting, and they didn't show very well.
Mm-hmm.
But even the one they did show fairly well, the ones that did are $30 to $40 a bottle.
Right. And in that price range retail, you can buy some really, really special wines. From both Europe and California.
Yeah. So
and Oregon and Washington State and other places.
I think they have a lot of work to do out there. And one of the things that I was talking about with friends after the fact was that Long Island wines are benefiting from and have been benefiting from for a while the idea that people want to drink locally. People are in New York City, which is a big city and a big consumer, and they want to drink local wines, and so they push local wines. That's only going to last for a certain amount of time, and then the wines have to stand on the merit.
You've got to catch up. And I think that any local area will do that. You'll support your local product for a little while on its own, but sooner or later you got to stand on your own merits. Part of the problem in Long Island is that land is so, so valuable that you need to charge a premium because it costs you a fortune to stay on the farm.
Mary Mulligan made a point. She said that it's the Long Island wine trade is now in its adolescence. And my point was either, okay, well, it's either got to get a job or it's going to stay a pothead and it's going to become, you know, a lackadaisical, underperforming couch potato. But, you know, the wines are now being sold because they're fashionable to drink. And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. And I think that for New York City to support Long Island wines under the rubric of drink locally is terrific. And it's given them a real leg up. However, at this point, there are people charging $30 and $40. And again, on this panel, my impressions of what the other panelists thought, there were not wines there that were good values, not a one, that for the quality and the price you had to pay. Now, the idea is if you're in New York City and you want to have a Long Island wine section or a New York wine section, there's a big event coming up called Uncork New York where they do that, that's really great. But there's no reason to buy that wine other than that for that price. Mm-hmm. And the Long Island wine trade is going to have to step up and figure out what it's going to do
when you don't put the wine in the bottle and people are searching for their wine off the shelf that they're just going to grab a bottle of wine. Hey, let's try this tonight. If the hit rate isn't at a certain percentage, people are going to stop doing that. They're going to stop experimenting with your wines. They're going to stop trying them time and time again.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking with the editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, and we're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects in the whole wide world, which is whiskey. So join us in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Coleman Andrews writes about food, wine, and spirits. He's editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, one of Mark and my favorite food magazines. His cookbooks are Catalan Cuisine and Flavors of the Riviera. He received James Beard MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award in 98, and that's a pretty big deal. And he joins us today to talk about whiskey. Hi, Coleman.
How are you?
Welcome to the show.
Now, Savoir Magazine is, and I'm not kidding at all, is one of Mark and my favorite food magazines.
Yeah, we had Melissa Hamilton on. She thought we were just blowing smoke, but it's really true.
Now, it's different than most food magazines. And I think, as an example, you wrote an article recently, the Drink column, and you wrote about Scotch whiskey. And you wrote a great article about Campbelltown, which is a place in Scotland where they make a very unique kind of Scotch whiskey. And, you know, overwhelmingly, because we read all the food publications, food magazines tend to have a female demographic. Your article seemed to be different overall, and I'm sure that the Scotch whiskey article was not designed to appeal to the female demographic. Do you have a different demographic that reads your magazine?
Well, first of all, I know plenty of women that drink Scotch. I wouldn't hang out with any other kind.
I agree.
A little, you know. In fact, I mean, I'm serious. I know people that get very upset when, you know, every once in a while an old fashioned bartender or restaurateur will say, "Would you like something sweet, madam?" What do you mean? Do I want something sweet?
Right.
I want a good drink.
Right.
Anyway, but we have about we may have slightly more male readers than our competition, but not a lot. And I think it's really a matter of doing, not letting that kind of decision make the choices for us of what we cover and don't cover. This is a legitimate topic to cover, and it's interesting to a lot of people, men and women, I hope. And we don't really consciously set out to write manly articles or womanly articles or whatever.
Well, let's talk about this manly article you wrote about the about Campbelltown whiskey. Have you always been a Scotch lover, or did Campbelltown steal your heart?
Pretty much. I mean, no, I've been, I guess probably until I was about 18, I was more into bourbon. Then I got into Scotch a little bit later. Now, it took me. I think Scotch is more of an acquired taste. Bourbon is a little sweeter and a little more accessible, so that's what I liked first. But I've always liked the idea of whiskey. And the great thing about being the editor of a magazine, of course, is that I can pretty much assign myself whatever articles I want. So I can, you know. So this was something that interested me, because every article you ever read about single malt whiskey will say, well, there are basically four kinds of single malt whiskey. There's Highland whiskey, which is all most of the very famous ones, and there's Lowland whiskey, which is a few distilleries that are a little less important, and then there's the Island whiskeys, Isla, I-S-L-A-Y, pronounced Isla, and so forth. Oh, and then there's Campbelltown. And I mean, Campbelltown was a sort of footnote,
right?
And I was always fascinated by it. I knew it wasn't a huge financially important part of the Scotch industry, but it was obviously distinct enough to be singled out,
right,
and to be separated out as its own area. So I made up my mind I would go there. As it happened, we went there, and the master distiller at the last minute was not available to us, so we went there twice. And it's a very nice place, but there's no good way to get there from here. You have to drive about 3 hours over very small roads from Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
So it was quite a thing to go back a second time, but it was ultimately worth it.
Let me ask you, you have a lot of pictures in here, and this really does look like, I think you write somewhere in the article something like, the Industrial Revolution doesn't seem all that far off.
Right, exactly.
Do you think it's a rustic travel destination?
I think you'd have to be pretty dedicated to the idea of this whiskey to go there, because there's not much else there. And
we are pretty dedicated.
And alcoholics.
Well, it's a pretty little town with a couple of little hotels, and, you know, as far as I can tell, only one restaurant that anyone eats in. And, you know, if you look on a map, it looks very close to Glasgow, but unfortunately, because of the way the configuration of the coastline, you have to drive all the way up and then all the way down, and it does take a while.
So
unless you're really, really dedicated. Although the nice thing is, there is a ferry in, I believe, the summer months, which goes from near there over to Isla, which has a whole bunch of distilleries and a lot to see.
Well, that's great, but there's no TGV from Glasgow to...
I'm afraid not. No, there's no tunnel or anything like that, no.
So,
it would be nice if there were a bit.
So we can only start on this topic, and we're going to have to take a break, but we'll come back to it. And when we talk about the different regions of Scotland, I mean, we talk about different regions for wine, and we see that the soil gives the grapes different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the different regions for distilled spirits, they don't really come from the soil. Are there different flavor profiles for the different regions? That was a lot.
Well, there are, and part of it is tradition and choice.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is the water, which is a very important constituent.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the individual stills. And I don't know if this is true, and if it is, how or why this would be true, but distillers will tell you, if they take everything from their distillery, all the water, all the malt, all the distiller himself, everyone, and they use, instead of their own physical still, someone else's a block down the road, the whiskey will taste different.
Mm-hmm.
And are these old artisanal stills? They're not.
A lot of them are, and especially Campbelltown has a lot of old stills. Another thing they say is, if you have an old still and it has a dent in it down here and a little scratch up there and all, you don't want to fix those things, because those dents and scratches give character
part of
the whiskey. That's what they say. I don't know if it's true.
You spoke for a moment ago about water. I mean, water, we know for a fact, okay, the bagels in New York City are different.
Sure.
Because of the water. The pasta in Italy is different because of the water. We know that water is a key ingredient to so many things like this.
Exactly.
Closing in on the last minute of the segment, I want to ask you, that whole, like, fixing the dents sort of thing, Do you think that's hocus pocus, or do you think that's true?
I'm sorry, the which?
That the dents and dings in your still can affect what it tastes like.
I don't know how else to explain the fact that, you know, you can understand more with grapes, because grapes taste different if you eat them in your the whole grape in your mouth, and you can tell the vast differences in climate and things like that. But you look at this, you look at grain, and it's basically more or less the same grain grown in more or less the same climate. What accounts for the differences, incredible differences in character? And I pretty much believe anything they tell me, because I can't think of any other explanation.
Our guest is Cole Manders. He's the editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, and we're talking about whiskey right now, Campbelltown whiskey from Scotland in particular, and we'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Coleman Anders. He's the editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, and we're talking about whiskey and a recent article he wrote in Savoir about Campbelltown. Coleman, we were talking about the differences in regions of Scotland. Like, each region has its own, has kind of broad strokes at which you can draw the type of whiskey. What makes Campbelltown so special?
Well, one thing that makes it special is that, in effect, there's only one distillery there. There are three, but one is owned by the main distillery, and another one has extremely small start and stop production. So, in effect, when you're talking about Campbelltown whiskey, you're talking about a kind called Springbank, all one word.
Mm-hmm.
And they're famous in the industry for being very independent. They don't belong to any of the industry organizations. They're one of the very few distilleries, possibly the only one in Scotland, that does everything, absolutely everything on site, from malting the barley, which is letting the grain sprout, which gives the malt its character, gives the whiskey its character, to actually bottling and everything else. Typically, these things are farmed out. People buy in malted barley from professional malters. People send out the whiskey in tank cars to be bottled elsewhere, et cetera. And they do everything there. The old Campbelltown style in the 19th century was very heavily peated, heavily smoky, iodiney, like the typical Lafroy or something from Islay across the water. What they have done more recently is to really create something that's more or less their own style. It has plenty of character, plenty of peaty character in that flavor, but it's not one of those ones that makes you think of a doctor's office, you know, the smell of iodine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this peaty flavor that we're talking about is unique to Scotch, and helps most people identify what
it
a
is
Scotch
a lot of,
is.
It's a lot of what makes Scotch a Scotch.
And that comes from a certain smokiness that you get in the Scotch that comes from taking the malted barley, which you make the Scotch with, and smoking it over a peat fire. And we know the peat comes from the peat bogs in Scotland.
Right. Now, there is Scotch whiskey, and in fact, there's a label that Springbank makes, which is dried in these kind of air blowers with no peat smoke at all.
Not peated at all.
Typically, the famous big-name single malts will use partially peated, there'll be some peat smoke drying and some that's not, so they control it a little bit.
When we come back from the news, we're going to talk with Coleman Anders about peated whiskey and unpeated whiskey and the great Scotch versus Irish controversy of whiskeys in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Coleman Andrews. He is the editor-in-chief of Savour magazine, one of Mark and my favorite magazines. And we're talking about whiskey before. We're talking specifically about Scotch whiskey and whiskey from the town of Campbelltown, which is also one of the recognized regions of Scotland. And we were talking about how most whiskey is peated before, which means that...
Most Scotch.
Well, I can't say most, but right. single malt tends mm-hmm. to so, have a lot of peated whiskey in it.
Right. And that by being peated, that means that it's the malted barley from which it comes from is dried over peat smoke, or at least some degree of peat smoke, which gives it that characteristic Scotch flavor.
Right.
But you were saying that some Scotch whiskey is not peated, and that's mostly the lowland malts?
Well, no. Well, the lowland malts are something we don't see very much here, bottled by themselves. They tend to go into blends. But Campbelltown has a label, for instance, that's called Hazelburn, which I don't believe is imported into the States, but that's the malt is dried only with hot air in these big drums, and there's absolutely no smoke at all. And then they have another one called Longrow, which is completely peat-dried. Springbank generally is a blend of some malt that is very heavily peated and some that's not. And this is one of the characteristics that different distillers play with to give their whiskeys different characters. If you taste something like Ardbeg from Islay, which was a distillery that was moribund for quite a while and revived about 6 or 8 years ago, that is, you can smell that from across the room. It's like a damp campfire almost. Mm-hmm. It's so smoky.
Well, now, the controversy I go back to Ireland a lot. I have family in Ireland. And there's the big controversy, because Irish whiskey is almost never peated except for Connemara.
It's very rare, right?
It's not peated at all. And so the Irish always say that Scotch whiskey is ruined whiskey, and the Scotch always say that Irish whiskey is unfinished whiskey because because they don't peat it. So what's with the disappearing E, man?
You know, I have no idea, and I can't answer that. I know that in America and in Ireland, the E is in there, and in Scotland, it's not. The term whiskey...
That's in the word whiskey
Irish originally, from Iscabeda, I believe is the mm-hmm. way it's pronounced. My Gaelic is a little rusty, but it doesn't sound much like whiskey, but I guess if you say it fast enough with enough whiskey in you, which means literally water of life, mm-hmm. even the Scots will admit readily that the Irish invented whiskey.
Right.
And that it came across. In fact, if you look at a map where Campbelltown is, it's a likely point of entry into Scotland. They can't prove it, but Campbelltown is the closest whiskey-producing area in Scotland to the island of Ireland. So it seems likely that some of the monks that developed distillation sort of came over that way and brought the practice with them, or perhaps smugglers, or perhaps smuggling monks, I don't know. anyway, but the two whiskeys generally do retain very different kinds of character. And, you know, there's something that you have in some Irish whiskey where you have whiskey made 100% from barley, not from other grains, but it's a combination of malted and unmalted barley.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a kind of it's sometimes described as a greener character or a spicier character in Irish whiskey. I love Irish whiskey. I go to Ireland quite a bit myself, and I think there's much more, certainly there's much more variety in Scotch whiskey, not least because there are only three companies producing whiskey in Ireland.
Right, three left.
There are two in the Republic and one in Northern Ireland, although there's a lot of different styles within that. But there's much greater variety in Scotland, and I think the Scotch whiskey at its best, Scotch whiskey can admit to more subtlety and complexity, and you can really get into, you know, trying to figure out the differences and the distinctions. But Irish whiskey is a great product. Nothing wrong with it at all.
I agree.
Coleman, maybe you can help us clarify the whole blended versus single malt whiskey conundrum.
Okay, well, single malt just means that it is a whiskey produced by a single distillery, of which there are now, I don't have this figure in my fingertips, but I would imagine in Scotland there's got to be a couple of hundred operating distilleries right now. What the whiskey that used to be sold, if you go back to, if you could see a typical bar, even in a very good restaurant or hotel 100 years ago or 80 years ago and even probably 50 years ago in the United States or in Britain, you would not find single malt whiskeys, or you might find one or two. It was not something that was sold individually. The whiskey was a blender's product. So the blender would buy whiskeys from a lot of these distilleries that used malted barley, also from distilleries that used grain distilled in a column still, that different kind of still as opposed to the big pot-bellied ones, that was more or less, I don't want to say neutral alcohol because it does have character, but closer to being neutral alcohol, closer to being a vodka or a something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would blend a number of different malts and a number of different grain whiskeys together and get a unique character that would be the same day after day, year after year. So,
so these would be
you bought Johnny Walker Red or you bought Dewar's or something, you knew what the flavor was going to be.
Mm, like Cutty Sark or J&B.
Exactly right.
And, you know, it's funny, this whole, the Scotch whiskey appreciation in the United States, when Mark and I started bartending some 20 years ago, there was, their single malts were Macallan, Glenfiddich, and Glenlivet.
Exactly.
And those are the three single malts you had behind your bar.
Exactly.
And now, what do we have, 25 single malts
behind
our bar?
I'll bet we have 35 or 40 single malts behind our bar right now. I mean, you have seven different Glenmorangie. I mean,
exactly.
But things went to from where, you know, the single malts where you had the choice of three to where it went crazy for a while. I mean,
right.
I think single malt was the rage, and now it seems to have settled back a little bit. Do you find that there's less of a craze for single malt whiskey than there was, and it's more mature, abiding hobby with people?
You know, I don't have the sales figures, so I don't know how it's
Culturally.
I know that just in general, I think the spirits industry is always trying to bring new products into the marketplace, and there seems to be a push lately for premium tequilas and for premium rum, which kind of both kind of got forgotten for a while. I mean, tequila never used to be available here, and there never used to be such a thing as premium tequila,
right,
even in Mexico. You know, good old rum has been around for a long time, but it's never had any profile here outside of the traditional cocktails. You know, whiskey is a single malt whiskey, as you know, is not something you generally put in a cocktail. You enjoy it by itself, and it's a prestige brand. It's something that tends to be pretty expensive. I mean, typically $50-$60 a bottle retail, often much more if it's an older one. And I think it's more like buying a bottle of cognac or some other liqueur than it is like buying a bottle of rum or vodka or gin.
You know, I think that early on, when salt malt whiskey craze began in the 80s and single malts became all the rage and blew into the country and really took over for a while, it was on the heels of, you know, these things come in waves. I mean, like you said, the one immediately prior to single malt whiskey was grappa. And grappa,
right, exactly.
And grappa was all the rage. And the thing about whiskey is it was all the rage, and now a lot of people tried it during that craze. And then they've settled back, and a lot of people have their favorite whiskeys now that they still drink. But things like the vodka craze, that's just brand-driven. And, I mean, I think that it's not that someone really has a love of that taste of vodka. It's they sort of bought into the lifestyle. But I will always remember the difference between the Scotch whiskey craze, which left people drinking Scotch once in a while and having a little knowledge of Scotch, and the grappa. Was grappa was written about in all the men's magazines.
Right.
To be cool, you had to have grappa.
And you had a couple of cool new producers coming up at that time.
And as a bartender, people would come into the bar and they'd say, I'd like a grappa. And I always wanted to say, no, you don't. Unless you're an old Italian man with a beret, you really, well, okay, I'll pour it for you. And, you know, then as soon as they choke one down and that was the end of it. Thank God Scotch came along. Hey, our guest is Coleman Anders. We're talking to him about Scotch whiskey. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardian Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our esteemed guest today is Coleman Andrews. He is the editor-in-chief of one of our favorite food magazines, Savour. If you want to subscribe to Savour and figure out how to do it, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and learn more about Coleman and Savour magazine.
You know, you're talking about things that come in waves, different liquors that come in waves. The next one that's coming, if it hasn't hit you yet, it soon will, is cachaça.
Oh, we love cachaça.
I'm getting a lot of new ones in, beautiful packaging, PR people calling up. It's people have decided that's a growth category, so we'll see.
Do you want to tell people about cachaça and what it is?
And in the past,
briefly, it's a cane, sugar cane liquor. You could call it rum. It's from Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
But people know it, if they know it at all, they know it as a constituent of the mojito, which is a very nice, refreshing cocktail, especially when the weather starts to get like this. But now people are trying to produce artisanal cachaça and expensive cachaça. And I have a few bottles of different brands here that are very expensive packaging, and they're $30-$40 a bottle.
Yeah, there were a couple of cachaça in New York, New Jersey area that weren't very good for a long time.
Exactly.
P2 was always the standard brand.
That's right. That's the standard bar brand. But,
and cachaça's history is that it was the distillate given to the workers in the sugar cane plantations
to keep them working.
Exactly. like grappa was the poorest thing. That's what you couldn't sell anything. You couldn't sell it, and what was left over when you'd made all the wine you could out of it, and you made brandy out of the remains of the wine and the dregs or the crushed materials, then you'd distill grappa, and then it got turned into this luxury product in hand-blown bottles. And
I'm going to put up on the website, and what I love about grappa is, we do carry Jacopo Poli and some high-end grappas at our Italian restaurant, but I remember, in Italy, the grappa would be, what the guy would bring out at the end of the night to let you know it was time to go home.
Exactly.
And he would bring out the gasoline grappa and pour it in your coffee cup, which means you're not getting any more coffee. Drink that and go home.
Exactly.
I want to quote you, as long as I've got you on the show. I love this quote from you. It says, it's from an article entitled Why We Like to Drink. You write, "I like the trappings of imbibing, the company it keeps, the restaurants and cafes and bars and the people who gather in them. I drink, frankly, because I like the glow, the softening of hard edges, the faint anesthesia. I like the way my mind races one zigzag step ahead of logic. I like that flash flood of the unexpected, utter joy that courses quickly through me between this glass and that one."
Did you really say that?
I must have been drinking when I wrote that.
You have a problem.
It's funny. I was just that article begins with a description of being in a restaurant in Europe and having had a lot to drink, and I just went back to that restaurant last week for the first time since I wrote that.
And it wasn't as nice as you remember?
No, it was unfortunately it was nicer. They'd cleaned it all up and made it very fancy, and it didn't have the same character at all. But
I think that I use that as sort of a segue into a point about there's in Irish and Scottish culture, in those two Celtic cultures, whiskey occupies a certain place in the social fabric. I mean, there are two things that you will always be offered when you go to someone's house. If it's a normal occasion and you're invited over, you will have tea. You better like tea because there's plenty of tea. But for any special occasion, it seems to me, is marked there with whiskey, whether it's someone you haven't seen in a long time or the passing of someone's passing or any special occasion. There's always a bottle of whiskey in the back cupboard where you have a little something to sip.
So it's a wee dram. Would you like a wee dram, they say, in Scotland?
Yeah, and I think
it's water of life. I mean, it's the thing you celebrate with. It's the thing you cry over. I mean, it's...
Do you find that it occupies a different position in Celtic culture than it does in American culture?
Well, of course, one theory I've heard advanced, especially in Scotland, where, as you say, I mean, the same is true in Ireland, where for anything, you know, you look tired, have a wee drum.
Yeah.
you look sick, have a wee drum. Oh, you just got off a plane, you must be jet lagged, have a wee drum. Yeah. You know, whatever it is. Somebody pointed out once that this may be a reflection of the fact that the Protestant ethic in Scotland says that in order to drink, you have to have a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll attach it to reasons like that, whereas in other cultures in Italy or France, let's have a drink because it's time for a drink
because it's noon.
Not because you're sick or jet lag, but so it's kind of an interesting approach. But yes, absolutely, it is part of the daily life, and I think it's something which in obviously taken in moderation, as with beer, the other great favorite beverage in the Celtic countries, is something that can be integrated very nicely into life, and people don't necessarily overindulge or get drunk. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that too, but a lot of people in the sense that you're talking about, with it being part of everyday life, it's just a little thing. And when they say a wee dram in Scotland, it is a wee dram. It's a less probably than a typical bar shot here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And and you just sip it or you throw it down and then you go on to something else. You don't sit there and keep work on the bottle.
I think that the interesting thing I find about wine and spirits and all of this stuff and food as well is the attendant culture and rituals around it. And it's funny, if you're ever invited over someone's house in Ireland or Scotland and they'll pour you a wee dram of whiskey and they'll put the bottle on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Don't grab that bottle. That's I've been where people have done that, and it's actually kind of rude. If you open a bottle of whiskey, you're responsible to keep your guest's glass full,
right.
And when you stop filling a glass, that means
they're supposed to go home.
Get out of my house. But I just grab my own and pour. No, I really don't actually.
Well, but the whole thing about the culture in which food and drink is presented is actually what Saveur is pretty much dedicated to, and that's why it's probably different from a lot of the other magazines.
It really is different. I mean, there's no question about it. You look at the magazine, you leaf through the magazine, and what we talked a little bit to Melissa about was how in-depth the articles go, and it's clearly someone who's traveled to the region and experienced it. It's a more, and I guess that's the best way to describe it. It's more experiential.
Did you say that for the end of the show to make this be perfect little radio show to have the answer to our first question come
exactly.
in the last minute of the
exactly.
show? That was really
right
beautiful.
Around there, yep.
That was really beautiful. Hey, Coleman, thanks for coming on the show with us.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
It's been swell to have you. Coleman is the editor of editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine. His name is Coleman Andrews, and you can find more about Savoir Magazine, how to subscribe, and more about Coleman on therestaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment talking a little bit more about whiskey, Scotland, and, my Irish heritage. Well, maybe not. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Captain Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today was Coleman Andrews, editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, and our topic today is whiskey.
Yeah, well, Coleman was talking about the hot new spirit is cachaça right now, and there's all these kind of boutique brands of cachaça.
We like the old stuff.
Well, I mean, P2 was never a great
there was another one.
Cachaça. There's a couple of other cachaças on the marketplace that aren't very expensive that are pretty good. But there was a drink that we used
Tucano
to make.
Tucano cachaça.
Tucano, right.
Finally thought of it.
There you go. There's a drink that we used to make with cachaça called a caipirinha. And it was bar sugar and limes, and you'd smash the limes all up in there. You take, maybe 3/4 of a lime, slice it into wedges, and muddle it, and really, really, really muddle it with a little bit of the cachaça and a little bit of sugar.
With a little bit of sugar and a lot of cachaça.
Right. Well, you start with a little bit of cachaça, and then you top it off and fill the glass, and then just shake it like you've never shaken anything in your entire life. Just shake and shake and shake, because that bar sugar has to dissolve in this cold liquid, so you really have to give it a good shake. And what a summery kind of drink that'll really get you drunk.
Oh my God!
So
what
careful.
A summer drink to drink.
So really, really be careful.
If you're home already. Now, actually, so it basically, if you look back at the ingredients of a daiquiri mm-hmm. is basically a lime sour, is a sort of a rum lime sour in a way.
Mm-hmm.
This is made with the cachaça, which is very rough around the edges. liqueur, and this is a Brazilian drink, is the caipirinha. And if you make it with vodka, which is a rather recent and not so good development, it's called
caipioca. I'm not crazy about that.
But I remember that it was many years ago. We're talking about, 16 years ago. When caipirinhas, I'm glad to see it's the next wave. I'm 16 years ahead of things. I was sitting at our former employer's restaurant on my day off and sitting in their outdoor cafe having lunch with my girlfriend, now ex-girlfriend of 16 years ago at the time, and Kurt, my good friend with whom I traveled the world.
That girlfriend has a high schooler now, yeah. Just in case you're wondering.
I'm sure she does. I remember that we sat there, and it was the first time I had really had maybe three or four, five caipirinhas with lunch, and so did she. And Kurt and I were going to New York to some concert, and she was going home. Now, we lived in New Brunswick, right? And we got home and said, okay, see you, Nancy. And she went off, and we found later on that we were going to the train station, and she was still walking around downtown. She's like, I don't remember how to get home.
Caipirinhas is very, very, very dangerous.
Put her in a cab and pay the cab.
It's very dangerous material.
But we'll put the recipe up on our website a little bit later on. That's what we should do here. Hey, I hope you enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Chun.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12:00.